Rows of old film studio buildings reflected in a shiny gold surface. As the surface turns, it's revealed to be the edge of a shield with the letters WB in its centre on a blue background. Warner Brothers Pictures, a Time Warner company. In shadow, an archer draws the string of his bow. A profile graphic of the head and shoulder of an archer in the centre of a black screen. Alcon Entertainment. Feathers hurtle through sepia clouds. A phoenix combusts in an explosion of golden light as it flies. Lightning crackles across the sky. Kadokawa Pictures. Alcon Entertainment and Kadokawa Pictures present, in association with Equity Pictures Median Fonds GmbH & Co., KG4. An Intermedia Films production. One missed call. The outside of a red brick building with white metal-framed window panes. The face of a terrified young blonde girl appears, pressed against one of the windows. A fire rages behind her. Patients are ushered away from the burning emergency hospital as firemen try to douse the flames. Windows explode outwards. A fireman carries the little blonde girl away from the building. She's clutching a white teddy in a red neckerchief.
St. Luke's Hospital, I repeat, St. Luke's Hospital.
Is anything hurt? Sweetheart, is your mommy here? You know where she is?
The little girl sits on a gurney, staring blankly at the flames and grey smoke that engulf the hospital.
Really? No. Don't come over. No, I swear, I wasn't just saying things. I mean, it could have just been a prank.
The young woman's on her cell phone.
I don't know who.
A cat jumps off the table beside her.
Not really. I'm just going to see a school tomorrow.
She's on a patio by a Japanese garden.
Thanks, Liam. Bye.
She hangs up and puts her phone down on the table by a large open book, a notepad, a coffee mug, and a bottle of pills. Pretty and dark, the woman, Shelley, looks up to see her cat perched on a rock on the far side of the pool. She turns to her book. Shelley looks up again. Her eyes flit about, searching for her cat, which has disappeared. Shelley frowns and stands up, then slowly walks round the pool.
Luna?
The water in the pool is dark and still. Its banks are fortified with rocks and it's flanked by overhanging trees.
Luna!
Curious, Shelley pauses and looks down. Large goldfish swimming in the pool. Shelley gets down onto her knees and leans down close to peer into the water. Shelley looks up to see Luna sitting on the opposite bank. Shelley's eyes are drawn back to the pool, from which a hand suddenly emerges and grabs her. The arm pulls Shelley beneath the surface. The water ripples. Luna, from her rocky perch, looks around for her owner. A small red ball bobs to the surface. Suddenly, the hand re-emerges and snatches the cat. Luna disappears into the pool. On the table, names on the phone's address book are flicked through faster and faster until the names are no longer discernible. Credit captions. Shannon Sossamon. Ed Burns. Anna Claudia Talanson. Ray Wise. Azura Sky. Johnny Lewis. Jason Begg. Margaret Cho. And Megan Good. Hazy and in slow motion, pedestrians on a sidewalk chat on their cell phones as they walk. Young people walk across a pedestrian crossing, many of them talking on their cell phones. A giant millipede in a jar. Casting by Nancy Neobatino, CSA, and Kelly Martin Wagner. Music supervisor, Dava Anderson. Music by Reinhold Heil and Johnny Klimek. Costume designer, Sandra Hernandez. Edited by Stephen Merkovich, ACE. Based upon the novel Chikushin Ari by Yasushi Akimoto. Screenplay by Andrew Clavin. Directed by Eric Vallette. A billboard reads, "Your phone, your life, reality wireless cellular." A huge metropolitan city. Production designer, Lawrence Bennett. Director of photography, Glenn McPherson. A party.
This looks the same for me, but that's not a good party.
Yeah, man, so now I'm having sex and phone sex at the same time.
A young guy, Brian, gazes at a woman as she chats to a friend.
I don't know, he was just so handsome. And I was so nervous, you know. And I'm trying to describe the plot of Beloved to him. I just start crying and it was perfect you.
The host, Beth, prepares food.
Brian, do you think you could get your eyes off Taylor for 2 seconds and help me with this?
Brian turns to her.
Unbelievable. And before the sheets are even cold. No wonder why Liam moved out.
I am a man, I have needs. Is that a problem for you?
No, but it might be a problem for Taylor.
He tastes a dish.
Yes, well, we can't force Taylor to have good taste now, can we?
He places a cloth over his shoulder that she's playfully tossed at him. They sit down at a kitchen table to prepare salads.
You know, I can hear you analyzing me in your head. You might as well do it out loud.
Okay, I think that you're still messed up over Leanne, and you think if you flirt with Taylor, maybe Leanne will get jealous and come back to you?
Go back to analyzing me in your head. I think I like that better.
Beth looks over her shoulder at the other guests.
Hey, did someone lock the door?
They ignore her. Beth stands up and makes her way through the crowd towards the white front door. She stops a few feet from the spy hole and stares at it. As though part of a dream, another door appears with a large knot hole in the wood. A girl peers through it. Beth glances through her spy hole. She opens the door and breaks into a smile.
Hey, Leanne.
I'm so glad to see you.
Too.
Is Brian?
Yeah, he's in the kitchen, so we should go upstairs.
Leanne, who's a slim, strawberry blonde, leads dark-haired Beth upstairs. They open a bedroom door to find a couple on the edge of the bed having sex.
Oh.
Embarrassed, the couple get up.
Hey, it's Leanne.
Bye.
The couple leave. Beth closes the door behind them.
Okay, just leave the alarm off. Thanks.
Leanne closes her cell phone and tosses it down on a bed. She sits by a window and gazes out.
Hey. How was it?
It was a funeral. It sucked. From now on, I only go to parties where no one gets cremated.
How are Shelley's parents?
Considering their 24-year-old daughter drowned in the backyard pond, they're great.
And you?
I mean, I knew Shelley. We interned at St. Luke's together. She was not crazy.
I know, Leanne, but the way that she was talking at the end there was pretty...
Yeah, that doesn't mean she killed herself.
They both turn to look at Leanne's cell phone on the bed.
That's not my ringtone.
They both stand up. Beth steps slowly towards the bed and picks up the phone. She looks at the tiny screen.
It says it's from Shelley. I'll be calling Shelley's phone.
She hands the phone to Leanne, who reads the screen.
That's creepy.
One missed call.
It's dated Monday, 10:17 p.m.
The clock reads 10:33.
It's Friday. Maybe you just set the date wrong.
Leanne frowns, presses a button on her cell phone, and places it to her ear. Leanne listens in stunned horror.
Leanne, what is it? Leanne?
Leanne takes the phone away from her ear. She looks at it and blinks, then holds it out to Beth, who listens to the message.
If you'd like to hear this message again, press 1. Voice call received Monday, June 12, 10:17 p.m.
I don't know, it's the weirdest thing. It's like every time I turn around, there's...
Beth narrows her eyes.
That's your voice. That's you.
A dingy concrete flight of steps at the side of a graffitied building by a bridge over a train track. In the shadows beneath it, two figures watch a video of a drug deal on a cell phone.
Yeah, help me get a break.
Oh, man, the price is, man. You gotta hit it right.
Give it
up. Okay.
Yeah. They're real nice.
The heavy-featured man turns from the attractive young woman. His cell phone rings.
Detective Andrews.
Yeah.
A pathologist's lab.
A group of hikers found her.
We held off on the autopsy until you got here, Detective. Even so, your sister was out there for more than a week. There's really no need for you to do this.
Detective Jack Andrews glances through an open door at a black body bag on a gurney. He enters the room alone, closing the door behind him. He takes a breath and bites his bottom lip. The black plastic body bag glistens under the strip light. He crosses the room to a brown paper bag on a small trolley. The bag is marked Andrews, Jean. He briefly regards it before turning to face the gurney. He rests his hands on his hips with a sigh, then steps forward and slowly unzips the body bag, revealing his sister's putrefying face. He steps back and covers his mouth. He leans forward and swallows as he examines her. He grabs a latex glove and tugs it onto his right hand. He reaches into Jean's mouth and takes something from inside it. He holds up a red ball about the size of a marble and peers at it. A lecture hall. Students, including Leanne, Beth and Brian, listen to a female lecturer, Dr. Cohn.
In cases of severe and repeated childhood abuse, the post-traumatic stress model may be valid. Long-term effects may include sexual dysfunction, amnesia, dissociation, even hallucinations and multiple personalities. The post-trauma child faces formidable developmental tasks, and among these, what we call dissociative virtuosity.
Leanne looks out of a window. A figure vanishes.
The post-trauma child will form primary attachments to develop a sense of basic trust and to preserve a sense of hope and meaning in life.
Leanne stares down over Beth's shoulder.
The child will, from this experience, attempt to construct an explanation of what's happened.
Leanne sees millipedes burrowing into Beth's right hand and creeping up her sleeve. Beth smiles back at her.
The child may blame themselves for what has happened.
If you come over earlier, then we can study some more.
Beth follows Leanne out of a university building.
Leanne! Hey, do you want to go get some coffee?
No, I've got to get to the library. Paper's due next week.
Are you okay? You seem kind of weirded out.
I haven't been sleeping too well.
Well, just call me tonight. I'll read you my paper on developmental perspectives in abuse cases. It's better than Ambien.
Beth smiles warmly.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Leanne sits hunched over a table writing in a partitioned booth in the library.
The library will be closing in 5 minutes.
She writes something in her notebook and returns it to a satchel on the table before glancing up at a clock. It's 5 to 10. She leaves the library and the lights go out behind her. She walks briskly through darkened streets. Her eyes flit nervously. She appears to be swathed momentarily in a windswept mist. A noise startles her as she walks along the damp, glistening pavement on the tree-lined street. She turns sharply and stares back the way she's come. There's nobody there. She reaches in her satchel and takes out her phone. Beth's typing on a laptop. She answers her cell phone.
Hey, Lee.
Hey. Hey, what's up?
Oh, I'm just finishing up this paper. What are you doing?
I just got sprung from the stacks. My brain was mushing out.
Oh, God, I know what you mean.
A zombie with sunken eyes stares at Leanne from aboard a passing city metro bus.
Leanne?
She gasps.
Leanne? Hello?
Listen, Beth, I didn't mean to ditch you after class today.
A pallid green corpse of a woman watches Leanne from a bus shelter across the street. She has a baby in a pushchair. Her pupils dilate, and as a bus passes, she vanishes.
Leanne, are you still there?
I don't know how to explain it. I've been having some problems.
What kind of problems?
Leanne catches sight of a white figure. It disappears.
Ever since, I don't know. When Shelley drowned, and that was my voice screaming. And then that bizarre phone call. And it was dated today.
Beth looks at her clock.
10:17 p.m.
Something moves on a bridge over the train tracks beside Leanne.
I don't...
Where are you?
I'm at the overpass on College.
Yeah, no, that's just 2 minutes away. I'll be right there, okay?
I keep seeing things. Weird people looking at me.
Leanne?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to panic. I've been seeing some really strange stuff. I don't know, it's the weirdest, weirdest thing.
Every time I turn around, there's...
Leanne's standing on the overpass. She's dumbstruck as the iron railings of the bridge over the track swing open like gates in front of her. A train approaches.
Leanne!
Leanne is swept off the overpass. The oncoming freight train slams into Leanne's falling body. Bystanders gasp. Beth sprints over to the train tracks and looks around in a panic. She sees a glowing figure through the gaps between the moving freight cars. She recoils as the figure screams and writhes. As the train hurtles past, the figure disappears. Beth looks around. She looks behind her, but there's nothing there. She turns to face the tracks, her rigid shoulders rising and falling quickly with each shallow breath. Beth drops her phone. On the stones by her inert corpse, Leanne's severed hand dials a number on her cell phone. Police inspect the body. A crowd of onlookers has gathered behind Beth, who watches as an officer removes a small red ball from Leanne's mouth with a pair of forceps. At Leanne's home, fellow students arrive to pay their respects.
Okay.
Brian sits out on the porch with two young women.
And then she got this strange phone call. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, Leanne told me the same thing happened to Shelley before she drowned.
That is so eerie.
Taylor!
What? I'm just saying what Leanne said.
Well, maybe this isn't the time, all right?
I heard Shelley got a phone call from an old advisor of hers.
Right, I heard that too, only it turned out the advisor was already dead.
Did you stop it?
Beth looks over.
Your parents are right in the other room.
Brian heads for the house. The two women, Taylor and Maddie, continue talking.
It's like dead people call you, but it's your own voice, and then you die too.
Brian turns towards them.
Shit, Taylor, you know what? Don't try to think, all right? It just makes you look ridiculous.
Pretty, raven-haired Taylor looks bewildered. Beth joins them.
I heard it too. That's it. Now I'm really creeped out.
It's shit, all right? It's total bullshit.
Brian glares at Taylor, who looks away. His eyes turn to the wooden pillar behind her, where two black millipedes scuttle upwards, disappearing into cracks in the wood. He slopes off.
Brian! Brian!
What's his problem?
He had a thing for Leanne.
Wearing a tight grey t-shirt and black skinny-fit jeans, Brian strides aggressively through the city streets. He looks up to see a zombie-faced construction worker staring down at him. The man nods, and a welding mask falls down over his face. Brian walks on through double doors into a cafe. He sets a takeaway coffee down on a table and shifts nervously in his seat.
Brian...
Beth joins him at the outdoor table.
Are you okay? What was that back there?
He slings his cell phone across the table to Beth and looks her in the eye. Pressing her lips together, she picks up the phone and raises it to her ear.
To listen to your messages, press 1. Voice call received Wednesday, June 14, 12:02 p.m.
Damn it, I forgot. I swear I didn't have my head screwed on it.
He fixes her with a hard stare. She returns his gaze and puts the phone down on the table.
The call came in 2 nights ago. From Leanne's phone.
That was the night that she died.
Only the call was dated Wednesday.
Today, 12:02 p.m.
It's noon.
I don't believe in magic, Beth. I don't believe in anything, but ever since I got that phone call, things have been... weird.
Like what?
He goes to speak, then shakes his head.
No, Brian, you have to tell me. That's the exact same thing that Leanne told me right before she...
Suddenly pale, Brian stares across the street.
Brian?
A twitching, pallid, hooded figure approaches.
What's wrong? Brian?
It passes through cars like a ghost, then vanishes. Brian turns to Beth.
Look.
What's...
Forget about it, okay?
No, Brian, don't!
Look, these things work because they get in your head, Beth. Hey, you're the psych lady, you know that. If you don't think about it, it can't hurt you.
A car almost hits him as he walks backwards into the road. He shakes his head.
Like I said.
He waits for cars to pass, then jogs across the road. Beth turns, startled by the noise. Her eyes dart left and right as she looks around her. Pensive, she picks up Brian's cell phone from the table.
Brian! Your phone! You forgot your phone!
Brian jogs back across the road towards her.
Damn it, I forgot. I swear if I didn't have my head screwed on...
An explosion on the construction site sends shards of metal and debris spinning through the air. Brian sinks to his knees, a metal rod jutting out through his chest. He coughs up a red ball, then collapses. Beth is interviewed at a police station. Jack watches from his desk nearby.
All right, let's go over this again. Welder's acetylene tank exploded. Your friend happened to be in the way.
Okay, and what about Leanne and the voicemails?
We checked on that. There were no voicemails on your friend's phones, either of them.
But I heard them, okay? Leanne got a phone call, and so did Brian, right before they died. Both of them did. And I hear it happened to Shelley, too. Shelley Baum, right before she died.
Well, thank you, Miss Raymond. We'll check on that, and we'll contact you if we need anything else.
The round-faced detective stands up and walks past Jack's desk.
What about the hard candies? Both of these kids were eating them. My sister, too.
Three people eating hard candy in 2 weeks?
The girl's right, Mickey. There's got to be some kind of connection here.
You know, I'm really sorry about your sister. But if it was my sister, I'd take some personal time. Just till I was thinking right again.
Jack catches up with Beth outside the station. He grabs her arm.
Excuse me, Miss Raymond.
Sorry, I didn't mean to startle you. I'm Detective Jack Andrews. I heard what you were saying in there, and, Detective Lee's a good cop, but she's a little short on imagination, you know?
What are you saying?
I don't really know, except Shelley Baum interned with my sister at St. Luke's. My sister Jean, she died in the fall 2 days before Shelley drowned.
I'm sorry. But then you see what I'm saying. Everybody seems to be linked together somehow.
Something doesn't make sense here, so... If you can think of anything else, give me a call.
He hands her his card. At home, Beth stoops to collect her mail. She discards all but one envelope. It's covered with tiny writing and scrawled drawings of crucifixes, forming a border on either side of the words, "Please open and forgive," and "Forgive your mummy." A flashback of a dark-haired woman smoking. Beth tears up the letter and throws it in a waste paper basket. She starts across the dimly lit hallway. She stops and turns on hearing a noise. She walks cautiously towards the sound. She peers through the doorway of a darkened lounge. Taylor sits in the dark with her back to the door. Beth approaches her. Taylor's been crying.
You didn't get a call, did you?
Taylor shakes her head.
But my number wasn't right, so... I'm gonna be next. I can feel it.
No, you don't know that, okay? Because my number is in Brian's cell, too. Here.
Beth takes the battery out of Taylor's pink cell phone.
No power. No problem.
She removes her own battery, too.
Any dead people call?
She slings the two phones onto the sofa.
We're not home.
The two phones lie discarded on the sofa in the shadows. A wooden crucifix hangs on a wall. Taylor and Beth sleep in separate rooms. Beth opens her eyes. Beth turns a light on in the hallway and creeps into the lounge, where one of the two cell phones is ringing.
Which one is it?
Taylor stands in the shadows. Startled, Beth looks at her, then at the phones, which lie face down on the sofa. Taylor whimpers. Beth leans forward and slowly picks up her silver clamshell phone from the sofa. She stares down at it and swallows. She flips it open. The screen is dark and blank. Taylor stares open-mouthed at her phone. Reluctantly, she picks it up.
There are no batteries.
She flips the handset open. One missed call.
It's 8:32 p.m. on Friday. It's 2 days from now.
She hits a button. A progress bar fills up as a movie downloads. Grainy footage of Taylor screaming. Through an office window. Beth leaves Dr. Cohn's office. Taylor's with a group of students.
Okay, you want to delete it? Do it yourself.
Look, I'm sure you'll be fine.
I want to do mine.
You want to do it too? Go ahead.
A second student deletes his number.
Go on, you can all do it.
Hey.
He hands the phone to a young woman who pushes a button. Beth snatches the phone and glares before leading Taylor away from the group.
I'm sorry, ladies. It just doesn't work that way.
Right. You're telling me that we can't cancel the service.
Well, you don't have to cancel it. You just use up your minutes.
I know. That's what I'm trying to tell you, okay? We don't want to use this phone at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, the phone is yours, so you can do whatever you want with it.
Taylor stamps on the phone. Beth finishes the job. Taylor kicks the remains down a drain. She looks at Beth with an air of finality. Beth smiles. They walk side by side down a suburban street. Taylor stops and glances up their sloping lawn to the porch, where a besuited middle-aged man emerges from behind a pillar.
Miss Anthony? Taylor Anthony?
Yeah.
Ted Summers. I'm a television producer. I work on the program American Miracles.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Well, some students called us about what happened at the school, and they told us all about your problem.
Can we help you with something? Because we're actually in
the middle... very moved by your story, Taylor. And we think that we might be able to help you.
How?
About 5 years ago, my son suffered a possession.
Taylor narrows her eyes. Beth shakes her head.
It was pretty devastating for the whole family. So when I created my show, I wanted to make it a point to build an extensive resource of people who were able to deal successfully with those evil influences like that.
What do you mean, like you do exorcisms?
I think this is nonsense.
Do you have the telephone on you, Taylor?
What?
Do you have the phone?
No, we threw it away.
Well, it would really be helpful. Here.
A cell phone.
Now, you show me exactly what happened when the phone call came
in. Okay, come here. Nope. Thank you very much. This is ridiculous. Thank you very much. Thank you. We don't need a reality show right now.
I just want to protect your
friend. I do.
I admire that.
Thank you.
The phone he's given her starts to ring and she flips it open. Shocked, they stare at it. Ted snatches it back.
Jesus.
Come on.
Beth steers Taylor indoors.
Wait, we can...
Hey, maybe he could help me, Beth.
No, Taylor, you don't need an exorcism, okay? That guy was so full of it.
Taylor walks away. Beth looks at her phone on the sofa. At home, Jack sits with his hands clasped by his mouth. He stares at the brown bag from the pathologist's lab. He opens it and removes a blue item of clothing. He stares down at it. He reaches into the paper bag and takes out a purse, which he removes from a transparent evidence bag. He takes his sister's ID card from inside it. He takes a cell phone from another evidence bag. He puts it down. He answers his own phone.
Andrews.
Beth lies awake in bed. Her bleeping alarm clock reads 7 a.m. She buttons up her cardigan as she walks into the hall, cocking her head to one side as she spots a note on Taylor's bedroom door. Beth, I need to be with my mom and dad. Love, T. Beth goes downstairs and approaches the front door. She stops in her tracks. A flashback of a little girl climbing a shadowy flight of stairs and peering through the knothole in a wooden door. Beth answers the door to Jack. They stand in the hallway.
Miss Raymond, it is not your imagination. The phone calls happened.
But the other detective said that nobody could find the voicemails.
It's only because the other detective didn't bother to check the phone records. I did, and it's all right there. Brian was called by Leanne, Leanne was called by Shelley, and Shelley was called from my sister. All right, and all the calls came in after the caller was already dead.
Right, who called your sister? If we could just trace it back to the source and find out who started this, then we would...
I was up all night tracking it down. I'm gonna go see her now. If I figure anything out, I'll give you a call, okay?
I'm gonna come with you.
That's just not a good idea, right?
Yeah, it is, because these are my friends, and there's no way in hell I'm going to sit here.
Beth strides out of the front door.
The call my sister got came from a nurse in an old age home, a woman named Marie Layton.
They pull up outside an apartment block in Jack's sedan. Inside, they walk down a graffitied corridor to an apartment door. Jack knocks. A woman emerges behind them.
I wouldn't hold my breath. Nobody's been in there for more than 2 weeks now. No soul.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jack knocks again. The elderly woman peers at them from her doorway. Jack stares at her, and rolling her eyes, she goes back inside.
You know, I'm gonna go get the super.
Oh, that could take hours. Why don't you just break in?
I'm a cop.
I'm not.
Jack takes a card from his inside jacket pocket and hands it to her.
Give it a shot.
She forces it in the gap between the door and the doorframe. Jack watches as she bends the card and struggles with the handle. The door won't open.
Okay.
Jack takes the card.
I was getting it.
Jack slides the card into the gap and turns the door handle. The door opens, and they walk into the shadowy hallway of the apartment. Jack peers into the lounge where clothes and puzzle pieces are strewn across the floor. He narrows his eyes and continues into an adjacent room. On top of a chest of drawers, ornamental letters are laid out to spell the word BELIEVE. Flies buzz around a half-eaten sandwich on a dining table.
Well, whoever Marie Layton is, she's a hell of a housekeeper, huh?
Beth walks further into the room. Jack enters the lounge where a red light flashes on a landline telephone. He pushes a button on it.
We're not.
Beth stares at dirty plates piled high in the kitchen sink. A rat pokes its head up from under a bowl and Beth backs away. Jack enters a children's bedroom. A messy bunk bed stands by the wall and toys are scattered across the floor. Jack crosses to the window and peers at a nearby tree surrounded by a cloud of flies. Sap seeps down the bark and millipedes scuttle across its surface. Jack turns from the window and looks down to see a grotesque figurine of the pallid, green-faced woman pushing a huge, bald baby in a pushchair. A white nurse's uniform is laid out on a bed. Beth looks down at it. She turns to face the dresser, where a framed photograph shows a slim, solemn, dark-haired Marie Layton wearing the nurse's uniform. Another photograph is torn into quarters. Beth pieces it together to show Marie sitting with two blonde girls, Ellie 10 and Laurel 7, the blonde child from the hospital fire. Beth turns sharply and stares into the dark recesses of a walk-in wardrobe. The door ajar, Beth steps closer. She opens it. A grey-faced doll falls and hangs upside down from a shelf.
Are you okay?
The doll resembles the zombie-like figure Leanne saw watching her from the bus. Footage of the kids on a small video disc.
I found this in the living room. Must be one of those nanny cams. To keep an eye on the children.
They watch it on a laptop. They return to the children's bedroom.
Okay, so judging from the angle, the camera would have been right here.
He stares at the figurine of the woman and baby.
So where did it go?
He looks around. Beth freezes, staring into a mirror on the wall. She turns. Jack pumps an asthma inhaler. He eyes Beth quizzically and she flees from the room. Jack joins her by the car, where she clasps her rosary to her mouth.
Beth, look, if you don't talk to me, I can't help you.
That noise, the inhaler, I heard it both times before Leanne and Brian. And then when I looked behind me, there was nobody there.
They share a look.
What the hell's happening?
On a computer.
This is the morgue file, the dead from the last month or so. Marie Layton died. She did it in another city.
I don't know how you stand looking at this stuff.
The dead ones don't really bother me so much. I'll take a look at this, all right? It's not a Marie Layton, but an Ellie Layton.
That's the older daughter from the photograph.
Yeah, it says she died of an asthma attack in her apartment. There's a CPS report attached, too.
He clicks on the link.
Child Protective Services, was she an abuse victim?
It says her mother was questioned by a psychiatric nurse at St. Luke's.
Your sister.
Cameras are set up inside a church. Ted.
Make sure Jesus is centered, all right? Let's go, people. Let's go.
Hey, Gary. This is a great place. I have a feeling it's going to be a terrific show. How's our girl doing, huh?
Not bad.
Ted smiles at an anxious Taylor. A clock reads 7:50.
This is Beth. I'm calling for Taylor. Taylor, when you get this, will you call me, please? Thanks.
Jean's papers. I haven't had a chance to go through them yet, but she kept records of everything just in case she had to go to court, so it's got to be in here someplace.
Jack rifles through a deep box of work diaries, notebooks and documents. He sighs. Beth looks on, concerned.
She was the baby. I was supposed to look out for her.
I'm sorry.
He retrieves a blue diary labelled 2007 and hands it to Beth. He takes out a notebook and opens it.
Is this it?
Jack stares down at the diary in Beth's hands. She turns to the entry for April 5th.
Yeah, it says there Marie Layton checked her daughter Ellie into the hospital for an asthma attack.
Okay, and here's the little one, Laurel, stuck a needle in her hand.
Laurel, insect bites, a burn on her leg, Ellie, another asthma attack.
Okay, Laurel again. Pesticide in her eye. Here's another one. Laurel ingested detergent. And there, another burn. And look at that. That's 9 admissions in April and May alone.
Munchausen syndrome by proxy. It's when a mother wants attention, so she keeps hurting her children so that they need medical help.
Yeah, but there's no way she could have given Ellie asthma, is there?
No, but she could have exposed her to something to set it off.
So Ellie has an asthma attack and dies. My sister starts asking questions. Marie gets nervous she's going to be found out, so she takes Laurel and disappears. I'm going to go get missing persons on this.
Beth looks at the TV. Wide-eyed, she turns up the volume. It's Taylor.
A cell phone rings and death is on the line. A beautiful co-ed, a ticking clock of ghostly murder. Next, American Miracles takes you there as a famed exorcist tries to outrace the mysterious curse that has already claimed 2 lives.
Spiritual energy exists in the same electromagnetic spectrum as light or microwaves. It's no surprise it can travel through cellular phones. And it grows there, like a seed, where it eventually manifests as hallucinations, spiritual disturbances, and finally death.
For you, darling.
Taylor, Beth.
Hey, Beth. Listen, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
It's okay. Just hold on. We're going to be there in a few minutes.
No, it's going to work out. I know it.
No, Taylor, listen to me.
There's nothing else I can do.
Shit.
Hey, everybody, here we go. Quiet, please. And 4, 3, 2.
We cast out this unclean spirit. Depart from here, Satan. Depart. Every demonic power, every infernal adversary, every legion. I command you. I command you in the name of God, in the names of all his heavenly angels, to be gone from this cell phone. I command you, by the judge of the living and the dead, you will leave my sister alone. Come out, I say, in Jesus' name. You serpent. Devil. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth. Haunt this child of God no more!
Taylor sees church statues come to life.
Stop tormenting my sister, you will come out now!
The man points at Taylor's cell phone with his Bible. Jack and Beth pull up outside the church in Jack's sedan.
I am calling you by name, Satan. Come out. Show yourself!
Studio lights explode. Beth and Jack enter.
Depart! Depart this place!
Hey, guys, take it easy. I'm a cop.
The studio lights strobe and Taylor starts to cry. A woman appears in a flash behind her, then vanishes. Behind the exorcist, a walking corpse with putrefying flesh staggers towards her with its belly on fire. Beth dodges a falling studio light.
Keep rolling.
A hooded child approaches through a cloud of smoke, then disappears. Seated beneath the crucifix, Taylor rises, swathed in a luminous mist. A hand reaches out towards her, and she starts to choke.
Taylor! Taylor!
Taylor's throat distends as if something within her is trying to exit through her windpipe. Ted watches on TV monitors. The digital clock refreshes to read 8:32. The power fails, plunging them into darkness. One by one, strip lights power up.
Hey, you okay?
Taylor's dead. A red, hard candy ball rolls from her gaping mouth.
Everybody back off!
To a studio technician.
Did you get that? Huh? Please tell me you got it. Huh?
The technician shakes his head. Jack checks Taylor's pulse. Beth opens her cell phone. One missed call.
Tomorrow.
At the station.
You weren't there, Mickey. You didn't see this. This girl needs protection.
From what? The ghost in her cell phone? Tell her to call customer service.
Jack, Mickey's got a point. Best use of people here is we find the doer.
Yeah. You're doing a great job so far.
Beth sits alone in an office by a tank of tropical fish. She rocks backwards and forwards. Jack enters, closing the door behind him. Wearing a shoulder holster, he sits down beside Beth and knits his hands together. They make eye contact and he shakes his head, then looks away, pensively rubbing his stubbly chin. He glances at Beth's cell phone, which lies on a small table between them. He puts the phone to his ear.
Voice call received Saturday, June 17, 7:55 p.m.
Why? Will you just tell me why?
He snaps the phone in two and drops it in the fish tank. Jack and Beth return to Beth's suburban home.
Like, are you sure you want to stay here? I mean, maybe you could stay with your family instead?
Well, my father's dead.
Well, what about your mother?
Beth starts up the stairs. She turns to Jack.
She and I don't talk very much.
Jack nods gravely.
You don't have to stay.
That's not going to happen, okay? I'm not going anywhere.
Jack takes a seat at the foot of the stairs as Beth goes up to her bedroom. She sits on the edge of her bed, staring solemnly into space. Jack stands in the doorway behind her.
Look, this isn't over yet. All right? There's still time to figure this out.
Not before 7:55 tonight.
Seated beside her on the bed, Jack sighs. He notices a row of dark circular scars on Beth's left arm.
Jesus, Beth, what happened here?
He reaches out, but she snatches her arm away and crosses to the window.
How old were you when you got those? 7? 8?
He stands behind her. She nods.
Was it your mother?
A flashback. Beth's mom jabs her with a cigarette.
Did your father know?
Beth nods. A flashback of her dark-haired mother, cigarette in hand.
When I call you, I expect you to come, do you hear me?
The 7-year-old Beth is silent.
Do you hear me?
With an icy stare, she points the burning cigarette at Beth. Beth scrambles to the corner of the room where she curls up, clutching her arm and staring back in fear. Her attractive, dark-eyed mother smiles coldly. Present day, Beth stares out of the window.
My father knew.
The flashback continues.
Cry, baby, cry. You're disgusting. Go ahead. Go cry to your father.
Beth's mum stands in the doorway, a cigarette smouldering between her fingers. Tears run down the young Beth's cheeks as her mum turns her back and leaves the room. Still clutching her injured arm by the wrist, Beth walks gingerly towards the doorway.
Daddy?
She stops at the foot of the stairs.
Daddy?
Beth creeps slowly up the darkened stairwell towards a heavy wooden door. The paint is peeling from the dimly lit walls. Light spills through a coin-sized knothole in the door. Beth peers through it. A dangling pair of man's legs comes slowly into focus. Present day. Tears roll down Beth's cheeks. Lowering her eyes, she turns to Jack and cries on his shoulder. Her eyes now dry, Beth sits opposite Jack.
Hello. Yeah, okay. Where? All right, thanks. How's missing persons? They found Laurel. She's in a foster home.
Petite, middle-aged Mrs. Ford.
She was at St. Luke's when it caught fire.
Right, so she was still at the hospital?
Yes, she'd cut her arm, and there'd been a report to Child Protective Services. They were holding her there until she could be examined.
And what about her mother? Do you know where she is now?
She hasn't been seen since the fire.
Beth and Jack look at each other.
Well, do you think we could talk to Laurel?
You can try.
Wearing a toy stethoscope around her neck and cradling her white teddy bear, blonde Laurel stares blankly ahead.
Laurel, there are some people here to see you.
Her eyes wide and vacant, Laurel sits with her back to the door. Jack walks round to face her.
Hi, Laurel. My name's Jack.
Expressionless, she stares up at him. He looks at her bear.
It's a cute little teddy bear you got there.
Laurel continues to stare.
Does your teddy bear have a name?
She hasn't spoken since the fire.
Laurel glances at Beth and Mrs. Ford, then at Jack.
Laurel, listen to me. It's very important that we find your mother. Do you know where she is right now?
Laurel plugs her ears with the stethoscope.
Laurel, do you know where your mother went?
She listens to her bear's chest.
Do you know where she is?
Arms folded, Beth looks impatiently at a clock hanging on the wall. It's 4:15. Jack crosses to Mrs. Ford.
Do you think there's maybe some way that you could talk to her? You might try talking to her.
Laurel pressed the bear's tummy. Beth is horrified.
What's wrong? It's just the song the bear plays.
Beth strides over to Laurel and removes the stethoscope.
Laurel, honey? Honey, do you know where your mother is? Laurel? Can you tell? Look at me. Can you tell us? Do you know? Can you say something? Where is your mother? God damn it!
Beth storms out of the house, followed by Jack.
Well, that was great. You know, you really have a way with kids, you know that?
We have 4 hours left. We're not going to find her in time.
Yes, we will, okay? The first thing we're going to do is we're going to go downtown and we'll hit the department computers. Everybody leaves a trail, ATM machines, credit cards, and we'll track Marie that way.
Okay, you do that. I'm going to go find out about the fire at St. Luke's because everything seems to start there.
Oh, are you out of your mind? Don't even think about that, all right? I'm not letting you out of my sight for a second.
Jack, we'll get more done if we split up, okay? And I'm safe until 7:55 p.m.
All right. I'll meet you at the library at 7 sharp. Here, take my other phone. Call me if you need me.
He hands her a black cell phone and starts the car. Laurel watches through an upstairs window as they pull away. Beth sits at a row of long desks with computer terminals. She types in hospital fire and does an internet search. Several items appear under Metro Citizens News Archives. Beth scrolls down until she comes to one item headlined, 5 Dead in Hospital Fire, Sunday, May 28. There's a photo of St. Luke's Hospital ablaze. Beth walks through the library down an aisle between rows of bookshelves. She glances down between the deserted rows as she heads towards a door. A woman leans over a water fountain beside it. The woman turns and steps past Beth. Beth swings round and stares after her. Half of the woman's face is hideously cut and bruised. Beth watches her go, then drinks from the water fountain. She looks up at a clock. It's 5:40. Beth returns to the computer terminal. The photo of the blazing hospital has changed to one of the charred building after the fire with the headline, Fire Struck During Visiting Hours. 6:35. Beth paces in a hospital. To a nurse.
Can you ask him to hurry, please? I've already called him twice.
Miss Raymond.
Dr. Painter, I need your help. Now, you were the doctor that was on the children's ward the day of the fire at St. Luke's Hospital, right?
That's right.
Okay, now, do you remember a little girl? Her name was Laurel Layton. She was 6 years old, and she had cut herself, and you made her stay there so that the CPS could investigate.
Beth switches Jack's phone off.
Shit.
Wait, sure, yeah, I remember her. Her sister had just died, and one of the psych nurses filed a report.
Right, right. Now, do you remember her mother? Was her mother there when the fire started? It was during visiting hours, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that wouldn't have made any difference. The mother was there all the time.
Beth gapes. Jack searches for Beth in the deserted library. In the back of a cab, Beth peers out of the window. She sits back, gets Jack's cell phone out, and dials.
Excuse me. I'm looking for a student. Her name is Beth. She was supposed to be here earlier today. Where are you?
I think Marie Layton was in the hospital when it burned down. I think that she might have died there.
No, that's impossible. All the bodies were identified.
I know, but what if they didn't find her? What if her body's still inside, Jack? She was a sick woman, a child abuser. So what if her body is still inside and her spirit's there, moving through the phones, attacking people?
Okay, all right. Where are you? I'll come get you.
Yeah, here we are, miss. St. Luke's.
What's left of it anyway?
Beth, no, wait for me, all right? I'm on my way.
Hurry, there's not much time.
Beth gets out of the taxi and stands staring at the grim, abandoned hospital surrounded by mesh fencing. The taxi drives off. Beth gazes nervously over the blackened brick walls of the charred building. An emergency sign is partly burned. Many of the windows have no glass. She steps towards the building, approaching grimy, glass-paned double doors. She tries the doors, but they won't open. Beth peers in, then hurries off. Inside, a shadow flits past the door. Beth steps around the building. Signs on the fence read, "Notice, no trespassing." Beth finds a gap between two fence posts and squeezes through. She runs down steps and tries a basement door. It's locked. She checks her watch. It's 7:30. She climbs the steps. Beth freezes. She turns around. The basement door is now ajar. Beth returns to the door. She pulls it open and tentatively steps into the gloom. She tries the handles of a cupboard, but it's locked. She reaches out and pushes up a lever, switching on a generator. Lights come on, illuminating the vast, eerie basement. Beth walks on with trepidation. An abandoned gurney, a trolley and a wheelchair stand in the deserted corridor. Paint peels from the dingy walls. Beth stands stock still and listens. With wide and fearful eyes, she steps forward again. Dull yellow light from lamps illuminate her way. Beth checks behind her. Terrified, she walks backwards, then turns and carries on through open double doors to a staircase, wet from dripping water. She stands at the foot of the stairs, then proceeds up. She heads down a ward on the upper floor, which is shrouded in shadows. Beth clutches her arms. A monitor, trolleys, empty seats litter the ward. Beth hurries on. A figure flits by behind her. Beth swings round and hurries after the figure through into another room. She steps cautiously through the gloom, then stands before a curtain, which she pulls aside. The curtain billows. She turns and moves towards a door. She reaches for the handle and opens it. Inside, there are children's cots. A monster baby looks up from one cot. Holding a cell phone, it sneers at Beth. Beth turns and races out of the ward and down the polished wood corridor. She reaches a fire escape door and tries to open it to no avail. She runs into a room packed with furniture. She pushes through it, shoves a wheelchair aside and runs to a boarded up door. She tries desperately to open the doors, but they're padlocked. She gets out Jack's cell phone. She holds the phone to her ear and waits. She looks at the floor, which is now crawling with giant millipedes, slithering over her shoes. She drops the cell phone. She's dragged face down along the filthy floor by the hooded figure. The corpse-like woman with the pushchair stands watching. Beth grabs the doorframe as she is dragged away. She stops moving. She looks behind. The hooded figure has disappeared. She gets to her feet and starts running. She collides with Jack.
It's okay.
She's coming for me.
Okay, come on, let's go.
Jack flashes round with his torch. They step up to steel double doors and push down on a bar to open them. The locks change. A putrefied arm reaches between the doors and grabs Beth by her hair. Jack pulls her free. She shines his torch on the doors, which are being punched from the other side.
What the hell is that?
The blows leave indentations in the doors.
Come on, let's go!
Leaving the imprints of faces.
Try those doors right there!
They hurry into a room. Jack shines his torch around. There's a large table in the centre. Monitors, other technical equipment and trolleys of surgical instruments line the walls. A figure in a nurse's uniform raises her arm and Jack is hurled out of the room. The doors slam closed. Jack is knocked out cold in the corridor. Beth grabs his torch and shines it around over monitoring equipment and cabinets of drugs and surgical dressings. Her face streaked with grime, sweat and tears, Beth tries frantically to open the door.
Jack! Jack!
Jack lies slumped against a wall in the corridor, unconscious. Beth struggles to open the door. She looks round to see a cell phone on top of a cabinet light up. The time on the screen reads 07:46:23. Beneath it, an egg timer turns over. Beth snatches it up and hurls it on the floor.
No!
The cell phone lands face up. A panel covering an air vent has fallen off. Beth stares at it, then slowly steps closer. Bending over, she steps through the large square opening in the wall. She crouches down and shines the torch into the air vent tunnel. She drops down into the tunnel. With the torch shining ahead of her, she crawls along the tunnel on her hands and knees. She pauses to look around, then continues on past the panels of other vent openings. She turns a corner. Another tunnel is illuminated. Beth looks up. In the hospital corridor, Jack begins to stir. Beth crawls onwards, travelling along a path flanked by narrow pipes. On the dust stretching ahead of her are another set of handprints. Surgical instruments are neatly laid out on a cloth on a trolley. The cell phone on the floor reads 07:49:18.
Beth!
Jack hammers on the door. Beth continues crawling along the air vent. Jack spots a narrow steel bar protruding from some equipment and hauls it out. Ahead of her is a tangle of electric wires by an air vent panel. Beth crawls up to the panel, pauses a moment, then looks to her left. A badly burnt, hairless corpse lies curled up against the wall of the vent. Clutching a cell phone, the corpse's hand drops to the floor. Beth stares at the phone. Its screen lights up. Beth studies the corpse. Beth reaches out, takes a grip of the cell phone and tries to pull it from the grasp of the cadaver. Beth wrestles the phone free and looks at the screen. It flashes, calling. Beth turns round and smashes the phone with her fist until the screen light goes out. Jack tries to wrench the door open with the steel bar. Beth glances behind her to see the rotting corpse crawling towards her. Beth scurries backwards. The corpse gains on her. Beth drops back onto the floor, the corpse on top of her. Beth slowly turns her head to look up in terror at the slavering cadaver looming down at her. A tear trickles down the grey, decomposing face of the corpse.
Why? Why?
The mobile in the hospital room switches off. Jack breaks the door open and goes inside. He sees the open air vent and drops down into the tunnel. He crawls onwards, then pauses and stares ahead to see two shapes. Beth drags the corpse towards him, then rolls over and looks at him. Outside the hospital. Beth sits in the open door of an ambulance. Jack comes over to her.
She had to be the first. She had to have my sister's number stored in her cell phone.
I know what she was, but I have this feeling that she brought me here or something to protect me. Otherwise, why am I still alive?
She looks up at Jack. Police swarm through the hospital. Carrying flashlights, the officers disperse throughout the gloomy building. Weak light spills through filthy glass windows at the end of a long, wide corridor. On the floor in the darkness lies Jack's black cell phone. A shadow eclipses it. Then it's suddenly lit by the beam of a flashlight. An officer picks it up by the antenna and seals it in a transparent evidence bag. Beth and Jack approach Beth's house. They stand on the front porch.
Do you want to come in?
No, I gotta go tell Laurel that her mother's gone. Besides, you look like you could use some rest.
Yeah.
Jack smiles, then looks down.
Maybe you could call me sometime.
How about tomorrow?
Tomorrow would be nice.
He starts for the car, but Beth takes his arm. He looks back at her and she smiles coyly. She releases her grip and starts for the house. The heavens open as Jack heads for his car. She stands by the front door and watches as he gets in his sedan. She goes inside and closes the door. She stands in the darkness, leaning back against the door with a long sigh. She switches on a small table lamp by the door, illuminating an envelope on the floor in front of her. She stares down at it, then picks it up. It's covered with tiny handwritten words and drawings of crucifixes and love hearts. She turns it in her hands and walks into the room. Laurel lies sleeping in her bed at the foster home. Her teddy bear lies beside her. Mrs. Ford stands at the door in a dressing gown. She smiles fondly, then goes into a corridor where Jack waits, his hands on his hips.
It's just as well. I'll tell her myself in the morning.
Jack stares at a notice board where a child's drawing depicts a woman with a pram and a creature wearing a red neckerchief.
What is it?
That's Laurel's, isn't it?
It looks like hers.
Yeah, that's the teddy bear.
Jack carefully lifts the pudgy teddy bear from beside Laurel. In the corridor outside her room, he opens the back of the bear and retrieves a video disc. He holds it up.
It's a nanny cam. It records what goes on in the kids' room.
They watch the footage on a laptop. On screen, Laurel sits on the bottom bunk in the girls' shared bedroom. Wearing a black hooded top, her elder sister, Ellie, drags Laurel to her feet.
Little girl.
A flashback. The teddy bear sits on a small shelving unit in the corner of the room beside the figurine of the woman with the pram and a jam jar containing an enormous millipede. Dark-haired Ellie casts an icy stare at her sister, who sits cross-legged in the middle of the room. Ellie pulls up her hood and takes a huge chef's knife from the shelf.
Oh my God.
Jack and Mrs. Ford watch the footage. Ellie turns and grabs Laurel's right arm up by the wrist.
Now this will only hurt a little.
Hey, guys!
Laurel clutches her arm. Their mother, Marie, enters, dressed in her white nurse's uniform. She strides over to Ellie and yanks her arm from behind her back.
Get away from her!
She pushes Ellie over and lifts Laurel.
It was you. It was you the whole time.
Marie walks to the door, carrying Laurel in her arms.
I should have known.
She slams the door shut as she leaves. The teddy bear nanny cam falls to the floor. Ellie pulls frantically at the door handle. She clutches her chest. She staggers to a desk and snatches an inhaler from it as she falls to her knees. She inhales, shakes it, and takes another before collapsing. She hits the floor with a look of horror and takes out a cell phone. Jack and Mrs. Ford watch as Ellie frantically dials. The millipede in the jar squirms beside the figurine. Ellie collapses. The phone flies from her grasp and her head comes to rest by the teddy bear. The grainy image on the laptop shows Ellie's face in close-up, her eyes and mouth wide open. Jack and Mrs. Ford turn to see Laurel standing in the doorway behind them. Jack goes over to her and squats to look her in the eye.
Laurel, it wasn't your mother who hurt you. It's your sister Ellie, wasn't it?
Laurel reaches into the pocket of her nightie.
But she always gave me candy.
She opens her hand to reveal a round, red, hard candy.
More stuff in the hospital?
Yep, CSU will go through it tomorrow.
All right.
See you later.
Yeah, take it easy, man.
At the police station, an officer hands a cardboard box to another sallow, corpulent officer through an opening in a wire mesh barrier. Wearing white latex gloves, he carries it away past shelving units lined with similar boxes. He strolls down an aisle and slides the box onto a shelf. He turns and retraces his steps. He stops and turns. He walks back towards the box on the shelf. He takes the box out and opens it. He holds the ringing cell phone inside the transparent evidence bag. The screen reads one missed call. He pushes a button.
Voice call received Saturday, June 17th, 11 p.m.
He checks his watch. It's 25 past 10.
No! No, wait, no!
Jack's on his cell phone at the wheel of his sedan.
I just thought you should hear this, Jack. Jack?
Jack takes the phone from his ear and rests his chin on it. Beth lies back on her bed listening to music on a personal stereo. Light comes through the rain-washed windows, projecting their image onto the ceiling. Beth stares up at the moving shadows.
Come on, pick up.
Beth's landline telephone.
Hi, no one's home. Leave us a message.
Beth, listen, okay? Marie wasn't the first.
He slams on the brakes, avoiding a grinning, corpse-like pedestrian.
So look, you were right. Marie wasn't trying to kill you at the hospital tonight. She was trying to protect you, all right? She was trying to keep her daughter away from you.
Beth is unable to hear his message.
Call me.
The digital clock on Jack's car stereo reads 10:57. A light on the cordless telephone's docking station flashes red. Beth removes her headphones and sits up, suddenly surrounded by a luminous, thin mist. She casts a tired-eyed glance at the clock, then switches on a lamp on her bedside table. She takes the unopened envelope, covered in handwriting and crucifixes, from beside the clock. Hearing the noise, she looks up. Wearing a dressing gown, she opens her bedroom door and goes into the dark hallway. She stares into a room at the end of the corridor. A figure moves in the shadows. Beth stops. She walks towards the doorway. She peers into the darkened room. Beth descends the stairs and approaches the front door. She stands at the door. She rises on the balls of her bare feet and peers through the peephole to see Jack. She lets him in.
Hey, are you all right?
Yeah.
All right, look. It wasn't Maria, right? It was Ellie. The whole time it was Ellie. She's the one who made the very first phone call.
What's that?
They look back at the closed front door. Beth watches as Jack walks towards it. He leans in close and peers through the peephole.
No! No, wait! No!
A knife stabs him through the eye. He collapses. The knife is retracted. The windows implode and Beth is thrown to the floor. She crawls on her hands and knees as splintered glass rains down around her. The front door swings open to reveal a pallid, ghostly Ellie growling and wheezing in her black hooded top. White-faced and demonic, she starts towards a horrified Beth. As she grows nearer, she holds out an open hand, inexplicably drawing Beth towards her. A figure appears behind Ellie and grabs her by the shoulders. A shockwave passes through Ellie's growling apparition, and she screeches as she's swept into a river of ghostly energy, terminating in Jack's cell phone on the floor. All is calm. Beth looks up to see Marie dressed in a pristine white nurse's uniform. They share a look, and Marie turns regretfully towards the door, vanishing into thin air as she walks away. Beth rises slowly to her feet and looks down. Jack lies dead on the floor, a red candy rolls from his mouth. The buttons on Jack's cell phone light up one by one as a number is dialed. Her face dirty and her hair lank, a shell-shocked Beth staggers away from the dialing cell phone. She stands stock still, gazing ahead, as behind her the phone on the floor continues to dial. Blackness. ITFC audio description written by Sam Clark and Aileen Downey, read by Alan Blyton. Produced by Broderick Johnson, Andrew A. Kossove, Scott Krupf, Jenny Lou Tugend, Lauren Weissman. Co-producers Alison Haskovec, Manfred D. Hyde, Stephen P. Wegner, Gerd Kirchlin and Elizabeth Cushman. Executive producers Joseph Lautenschlager, Martin Schurman, Andreas Theismeyer, Timothy M. Bourne, Shinya Egawa. Additional casting by Shay Bentley Griffin. Extras casting by Jeff Olan. Cast: Beth Raymond, Shannon Sossamon, Jack Andrews, Edward Burns, Taylor Anthony, Anna Claudia Talanson, Ted Summers, Ray Wise, Leanne Cole, Azura Sky, Brian Souza, Johnny Lewis, Ray Purvis, Jason Begg, Mickey Lee, Margaret Cho, Shelley Baum, Megan Good, Marie Layton, Rhoda Griffiths, Monster Marie, Dawn Dininger, Eddie Layton, Ariel Winter, Monster Ellie, Sarah Kubik, Laurel Layton, Regan Lamb, Mrs. Ford, Karen Bayer, Child Beth, Alana Locke, Gary, Dave Spector, Dr. Julia Cohn, Mary Lynn Owen, Dr. Painter, Roy McCrary, Reception Nurse, Lauren Payton, John, Greg Corbett, Coroner, Donna Bisco, Old Lady, Edith Ivy, Lieutenant, Wilbur Fitzgerald, Howie, Bart Hansard, Boost Mobile Clerk, Randy McDowell, EMS Aide, Jody Thompson, Fire Captain Jeff McKnight, Maddie Katie Nealand, Taxi Driver Bob Seal, Dr. Brown Jason Horgan, Production Assistant Rona Nix, Jewel Kara Whithead. Patrolman, Jeff Portell. Artiste, Luke Williams. Player guy, Brian Beagle. Freshman girl, Kendall McRae. Student 1, Demontrez Spears. Student 2, Amber Wallace. Sound mixer, Craig Woods. Supervising sound editors, Cami Asgar, MPSE, Sean McCormack, MPSE. Dialogue editors, Scott G.G. Haller, MPSC, Devin Joseph. ADR supervisor, Linda Folk. Sound designer, Dorian Chia. Sound effects editors, John Marquis, Ben Cook, Herwig Mora, Michael Dressel, Tim Totrello. Assistant sound editor, Jake Reel. Apprentice sound editor, Joseph R. Branca. Foley supervisor, Jonathan Klein. Foley artists, Pamela Kahn, Vincent Giussetti. Foley mixer, Kyle Rochlin. Score recorded at Climax Studios, Hollywood, California, and Power Blue Studios, Santa Barbara, California. Score arranged and performed by Johnny Kleineck, Reinhold Heil, Gabriel Isaac Mouncey, Jonathan Shaines, Bruce Winter. Additional music, Gabriel Isaac Mouncey, Bruce Winter. Score mixed by Bruce Winter. Strings and Brass, Orchestra.net. Conductor, Adam Clemens. Contractor, Steve Solani. Lead orchestrator, Bronwyn Jones. Additional orchestrations, Leah Curtis, Jonathan Shaines. Ringtone written and performed by Dave Stewart. Music preparation, Eric Stonerock. Music editor, Tommy Lockett. Music coordinator, Delphine Robertson. Munich, written by Tom Smith, Chris Urbanowicz, Russell Leach and Ed Lay, performed by the editors. Valley Stream, written and performed by the Blue Jackets. Destroy Everything You Touch, written and performed by Ladytron. Shadowing, composed by Philippe Bestion. Sunlight Makes Me Paranoid, written by Diego Garcia, performed by Elephant. Dreamin', written by Pete Shelley, performed by Buzzcocks. Il Mistero del Tempo, written by Barry Andrews and Carlo Asciotti, performed by Shriekback. Netscape and the Netscape N logo are registered trademarks of Netscape Communications Corporation, used with permission. Copyright Equity Pictures Medienfonds GmbH & Co. KG4, all rights reserved. Equity Pictures Medienfonds GmbH & Co. KG4 is the author and creator of this motion picture for the purposes of copyright and other laws in all countries throughout the world. This motion picture is protected under laws of the United States and other countries. Any unauthorised exhibition, distribution or reproduction of this motion picture or videotape, or any part thereof, including the soundtrack, may result in civil and criminal penalties. Equity Pictures, Warner Brothers, a Time Warner company.